and welcome to the American Compass podcast. I'm Oren Cass, Executive Director at American Compass, and this is Talking Policy Shop season number 2. We're back with Chris Griswold. Chris, how are you?
I'm great, Oren. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm very excited for this second season. I feel like your typical sitcom has a rough first season. The actors are getting to know each other. We don't really, as an audience, have a good feel for the characters. We don't understand their relationships. But no longer. No longer.
No longer. We're reaching our peak prestige TV, you know, apogee.
I was thinking more Friends, that you could be the Joey to my Chandler. But regardless, we'll let the listeners decide that. Season 2 will be a little bit different. The policy proposals in Season 1, of course, were codified in the epic Rebuilding American Capitalism Handbook, available in print and on our website. Season 2 is going to be focused on issues 2024, the issues that are, or at least should be, driving the primary campaign. Are you ready?
I'm ready. And as you said, I mean, we have typically in the past focused on individual policy proposals. Today, we're going to kick off season 2 with asking voters what they think about particular policy proposals. We just recently surveyed 1,000 Republican voters to ask them what they think about the economic policy items that are or are not and should be part of the conversation in the 2024 primary campaign. So why don't you talk a little bit about how we designed this survey, and we can get into what we found.
Yeah, so the survey had two parts. The first was just trying to get a handle on what issues Republican voters are most focused on, see as the biggest challenges for America. So we'll start there, and then in a little bit we can talk about the second part, which was their actual policy views on various things. But I think the issue part was really interesting, because it feels like the issue set that, you know, conservative voters are focused on, that you see politicians talking about, is shifting significantly. And I think there have been a number of polls that try to get at this. But frankly, they tend to ask sort of generic questions where your choices are things like jobs and the economy. And of course, jobs and the economy always scores very highly. Everyone cares about jobs and the economy.
I, too, love being employed.
But that doesn't translate naturally in all cases to the sort of issues politicians can actually focus on and the things that they'll say they do. And so what we did was we actually created a list of 12 different challenges that we thought represented sort of a wide range of different perspectives that you might see political figures coming to the electorate from and that you might see voters focused on. There were three that I would call sort of old right challenges, the things that you've historically heard Republican candidates talking about, things like tax rates are too high, regulation is strangling businesses, you know, in the current environment, tariffs are raising prices and interfering with free trade. Then we also had three new right challenges, much more in keeping with the sorts of things we focus on here at Compass, with manufacturing being gutted by globalization, workers lacking control over their jobs and power to do anything about it, people making more money working on Wall Street than building real businesses. Then we had three of what I would call consensus challenges, pretty much wherever you are on the right of center, you're probably unhappy about these things. You know, illegal immigration, undercutting American workers, family issues with not enough people getting married and having kids. And then an education system that only works for people who are going to college. And then finally, the last three are what I would call cultural challenges, really focused on the relatively newer cultural issues that I think have popped up in the last couple of years, concerns around transgender activism, woke corporations, and critical race theory and the way it's taught in schools and even businesses and the military. So we gave folks those 12 and asked them to choose which do you think are most important. You know, choose at least two, choose up to five, and you can also choose none of the above if you want. Chris, how would you guess our Republican electorate responded to this set of challenges?
Well, I don't have to guess because I'm looking at the fantastic survey report that we just generated that will be on our website. And as I think no one will be surprised to hear, the cultural issues on the minds of conservative voters came to the front in a big way. That seems to drive people's immediate response. But what's really interesting to me is when you get past that initial kind of common front on cultural issues among the GOP base, then you start to see some really interesting divides on these other issues between the old right economic perspective that you described and the newer right economic perspective you described. And that's where you see, I think, the real underreported contest that will end up, and I think, defining the future of the conservative movement and the Republican Party based on how that fight plays out. We all know that the GOP base cares about these cultural issues. We all know that the GOP base agrees on some of those consensus issues that you pointed out, like immigration and family. What they don't agree about yet are the economic issues. And what's most interesting to me, and I'd love to hear you talk more about this, is the trend lines and which of these two camps seems to be winning and gaining the momentum.
Yeah, so I want to be sure to first pat ourselves on the back. You know, I think we asked questions and got answers that seem to reflect a lot more closely what politicians out there in the world are actually seeing. You know, as we said a moment ago, look, if you just ask people, do they care about jobs and the economy? People say, yeah, I care about jobs and the economy. And then you write your piece saying, why are all these politicians focusing on these cultural issues when what voters want to hear about is jobs and the economy? What we found is the things that Republican voters see as the most important challenges are, in fact, the transgender, woke, critical race theory and illegal immigration as the top four. And I think also really interesting, those three cultural issues in particular, those are pretty much the top issues for everybody. no matter what demographic group you look at, how you try to cut it, even if you look specifically at people who care about something else. So for instance, among people whose top issue is tax rates or who list that as a top issue, their other top issues are also the cultural issues. And so it really is striking, I think, the degree to which that is top of mind for this electorate at this point. But to your point, that's almost table stakes here. There is no disagreement on among the politicians or within the party or really the conservative movement about those being important issues and about, broadly speaking, the, you know, which side of them to be on. What's really interesting is to then say, okay, well, you are also going to, of course, have an economic agenda to go with that. People do also care.
Or not, as the case may be, have an economic agenda to go with it. And I think what's so interesting about this, at least to me, is to also think back to the 2022 midterms, in which Republicans underperformed relative to expectations, won the House, but only barely, and we're still seeing the consequences of that slim majority, failed to retake the Senate when they were expected to. And we've talked a lot about this in other forums, but it seems to me that a big part of the explanation for that was the failure to bring a coherent economic message to the voters and explain, here's what we are going to do on the economy if you give us power. And the campaign focused entirely on these cultural issues, and we saw the limit of only doing that. If that's the only thing you're bringing to the electorate, it will get you thus far, but no further. And I think that's an important bit of context into which this survey speaks.
That is a fair point. You certainly can fail to say anything about jobs in the economy. We just wouldn't advise it. And, you know, I think you see even in how the 2024 candidates are proceeding, you know, giving that economic speech is certainly considered very important. You know, I think Governor DeSantis has done one. Ambassador Haley just did one. It's something folks seem to recognize they need to have a view on. But what's so interesting is that this is where you see a very sharp divide. You see some voters who are very focused on what I would call the new right issues and some on what I would call the old right issues. And unlike when it comes to those cultural issues or those consensus issues where there's a lot of overlap in interest, here the interest is quite divergent. So what we did was we took all the voters and broke them into three groups. You've got your new right voters, meaning they give more weight to the new right issues than they do to the old right issues. You've got your old right voters who give more weight to the old right issues. And then you've got your neither or same who end up giving the same weight to them, and they do that typically because they've given no weight to either. They're focused only on the consensus and cultural issues. And what's really interesting is that of those three blocks, the new right bloc is the largest. So you end up with, you know, about 42% who are in that new right bloc. You've got about 29% in the old right bloc, and you've got about 28% in the neither bloc. And so the new right bloc, talking about issues that, you know, until very recently you would not have heard anyone on the right of center talking about, is the largest bloc, and it's about 50% larger than the old right bloc. So there's a significant gap there, and it's a gap across all demographic groups. So whether you're looking at it by age, race, gender, ideology, class, the new right bloc is always bigger. We actually did an exercise to say, all right, well, surely we can find somewhere where where the old right bloc is bigger. And the only way I could find to do it was you had to cross class and gender. So upper class men, you know, college educated, earning six figures, they actually do flip over into being majority old right voters. But that's about 4% of the Republican electorate. And so I think what you see is, you know, not only a shift that's underway. I mean, I think if you suggested to someone, you know, a decade ago, hey, let's do this kind of survey, they you'd say, who on earth are you going to find that's a new right voter? Not only a shift, but already a swing to it being the larger bloc. And that being said, you also see a situation where you really kind of have to choose. And I think this speaks somewhat to, you know, in 2022, the difficulty of creating a platform. These two things don't overlap. They're in conflict. And talking to one group of voters is going to be very unsatisfactory to the other group, whichever way you go. And so I think one thing we're, you know, especially interested to watch as this campaign unfolds is, you know, who tries to go one way, who tries to go another way, who tries to have it both ways, and who just tries to avoid it and focus on the things they think everyone will agree on, because it's an important strategic choice, and it will certainly have a lot of implications for, I think, what kind of policies get talked about and how the race gets covered.
Well, maybe it would be interesting to dive into some of the specific policy questions that we asked the survey respondents then, because some of them, I think, paint this picture particularly starkly. And I'm not sure there's any issue that more cleanly illustrates this divide than trade and globalization. So we asked a question on tariffs, and I want to actually read the wording of the question so that our listeners know we tried to be fair and balanced about how we worded it. Here's
fair
the question.
And balanced. You are in the no-spin zone.
That's right. A tariff is a tax placed on a product imported from a foreign country. Some people support imposing tariffs on imports because they say it will reduce imports and encourage businesses to make more things in America and employ more American workers. Other people oppose imposing tariffs on imports because they say it interferes with free trade and raises prices for consumers. Which is closer to your view? And then the options were, one, I support tariffs. We need to boost American manufacturing. And two, I oppose tariffs. Free trade lowers prices for consumers. And the divide on this question was remarkable. 77% supported option one, I support tariffs because manufacturing needs to be boosted. Only 23% chose option two. That is a massive divide, and it does not reflect, I think, most people's outdated stereotype of where the GOP is. The GOP, at least in terms of where its voting base is no longer the party of free trade. It's the party of protecting American industry. And the sheer scale of that result, I think, really speaks to the fact that this, as you said, this is not only a realignment in progress, in some instances at least, it's a realignment that's already happened. And the candidates that are speaking to it seem to find resonance for that reason. I found there's one other thing I want to point out about this result specifically that I found very interesting, which is that if you divide up the responses by class on this question, working class respondents were the strongest. 83% of working class respondents chose the I support tariffs option. Now the response was strong. It was over 70% or over in all classes, but working class was over 80%. And as the Republican Party, starts to talk about being the party of working class people, which is now a pretty common, political piece of rhetoric, this to me is the most obvious place to start if you're trying to find working class support.
Yeah, I think the working class result is interesting. The other one I find really interesting here is when you look at new right versus old right voters on it. Unsurprisingly, new right voters are much more in favor of tariffs. 84% I support tariffs, but old right voters are still 69% in favor. And that's even with, to your point about trying to word the question fairly, we don't hide what a tariff is. The first four, five words of the description are a tariff is a tax. And so, even when you right up front say, look, we're talking about a tax, you ask people on, Republican voters who are more inclined to focus on tax cuts, deregulation, hey, what do you think of it? Even they are by more than 2-1 saying they support that at this point because of the importance of supporting American workers and boosting American manufacturing rather than supporting free trade and lower prices.
All right. So Oren, that's the low-hanging fruit. Give us something else. What's your most notable specific policy question?
I'm going to cheat. I want to throw in just a 1A because it occurs to me that, one thing people could say about this is, well, this is just Trump. Trump supports tariffs, therefore, that's what people think their answer is going to be. So I just want to note, and if you want to get on all the detail on it, check out the full report on our website. But we separately asked an industrial policy question. We specifically highlighted Congress passed the Chips and Science Act, $50 billion from the federal government to help semiconductor companies. And asked people what they thought of that, whether government should provide support to ensure that America is a leader in advanced technologies like semiconductors. Now, this is not a Trump policy at all. Obviously, it was bipartisan in Congress, but most Republicans still voted against it. On this question, you get the exact same result. In fact, one point, no difference within the margin of error compared to tariffs, but 78-22. Yes, the government should be providing support to industries like the semiconductor industry. So, I definitely think this reflects a more genuine change in thinking rather and priorities rather than just, Donald Trump, doesn't he like tariffs?
Well, and across class as well, if you look at the class breakdown on this question, lower, working, middle, upper class, all over 75%. Actually, I think it's 78% in two cases, 79 and then 81, which is just unbelievably dominant.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, that doesn't count as mine. For my first one, I want to talk about, it's funny, it's actually the last question that we added to the survey, and I'm so glad that we did, because it's not a specific policy issue, but it's a question of sort of how you think about economic policy, and it's a question about the labor market. We asked, the description we gave was, in the past couple of years, many employers have complained that they cannot find enough workers to hire. Some people call this a labor shortage and say that it is a major problem because businesses can't grow and their costs go up, leading to higher prices for consumers. Other people call this a tight labor market and say it is a good thing because it will force employers to offer better jobs and pay higher wages, spreading more prosperity to workers. Which is closer to your view? And the two views, the concrete descriptions we gave was either we have a tight labor market, which is good. Employers should offer better jobs and higher pay if they need more workers. Or we have a labor shortage, which is bad. Policymakers should consider solutions like higher immigration to provide more workers. Now, I think this is sort of a quintessential summary of this debate that has been going on in economic policy circles over the past couple of years. Obviously, you have the business community very strongly on the labor shortage side. to the extent that that the Republican Party is still the party of business or even small business, you would expect them to be very sympathetic to the labor shortage view. But by 85 to 15, Republican voters chose the tight labor market view. To your point, looking at class, the highest support, unsurprisingly, is working class voters, 90 to 10, really buying into the tight labor market framing. But again, across classes, you're above 75% in every class, and you're above 75% both new right and old right. And so I think that really underscores that, you know, look, are you going to always have a segment whose economic interest is in a looser labor market? Sure. But when it comes to very broadly, whoever you're speaking to among Republican voters, there's a very strong view that tight labor markets are good, tighter labor markets are better, and we should be celebrating that, not talking about how to relieve it.
I think it's interesting to note, too, not only breaking it down by class, but by ideology. If you step down from moderate to conservative to very conservative in terms of how these respondents identified themselves, the more conservative you get, the more you feel the way you just described, rather than the other way around. So the most dedicated kind of core of the voting base, if you will, thinks this way rather than the other way around, which I found pretty striking.
Yeah. All right, your turn.
All right. Well, so you mentioned how tariffs might be a trick question because of Trump, and frankly, industrial policy, I think also you could say the same thing because it's about China. In fact, both tariffs and industrial policy could be framed as responses to our competition with China. So I was fascinated by the question we asked about Wall Street because that's domestic, and if we really want to test the question, you know, have Republican voters moved past this free market fundamentalism, alt-right view, it's pretty fair to ask, all right, let's take our geopolitical competition out of it, because that does garner a lot of shared sympathy, and just ask a question about Wall Street. So here's the question we asked. Investment banks, hedge funds, and private equity firms raise hundreds of billions of dollars every year, which they use to generate profits from buying and selling companies and making stock market trades. Some people say these activities are important to the health of America's economy and help it grow, creating better jobs and higher wages. Other people say these activities often ruin companies and treat the stock market like a casino, allowing some people to get rich while leaving everyone else behind. Which is closer to your view? And 57% of respondents said that Wall Street investors are getting rich doing things that weaken our economy. And only 43% said that Wall Street investors play an important role in strengthening our economy. That was striking to me. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, there is some difference when you break it down by class on this question. Finally, we get something below 50% for upper-class people. You know, 42% for upper-class. I guess maybe that speaks, I'm speculating here, but of the professions in which those particular folks may be employed. But if you go down to middle class, it's 52%, working class 60%, so approaching 1 in 3, and then lower class it's 74%, approaching 3 in 4, and that I think when you talked earlier about there being a real kind of time for choosing, so to speak, and a real choice to be made, I think this question points to the choice that candidates and elected officials will have to make between whose interests to prioritize. Because on this instance, the bulk of the response was in favor of a view that Wall Street is not doing things that are in the interest of the country. But it does shake out a little differently based on class. And so there is, at least as I'm reading these results, a real choice to be made here.
Yeah, and it shakes out different by that new right versus old right also. You've got 65% Wall Street investors are getting rich doing things that weaken our economy in the new right block, but only 49% in the old right block. Honestly, 49% in the old right block, not a low number, but certainly you face a different calculus. And, you know, this, I think, was probably the single most striking result in the issue survey because, you know, when we survey these issues, we know there are some where sort of, you know, American compass is on the, quote, winning side, and others where we are at least not yet on the winning side. And that's fine. We're not doing the polling to prove that everybody agrees with us on everything. We're doing it to show, you know, here is where views are today. And I would have expected the Wall Street question to be one of the ones that was lagging furthest behind in terms of shift toward the new right, you know, in large part because it's not something that you see a lot of conservative elected leaders talking about. You know, to your point about as compared to tariffs, let's say, you know, you don't have Trump out there sort of leading the charge in a new direction on this issue. Frankly, you don't really have anyone out there leading the charge in a new direction on this issue. And yet I think ultimately, and this goes back to that place I started on just how do you think about the labor market, what you see is just a different way of thinking about the economy generally and a willingness to move beyond trusting that whatever is good for business is going to be good for everybody, and instead looking around and saying, well, wait, I'm not so sure it has been good for everybody, and I'm actually allowed to say that. So, you know, I think this certainly reflects a tension within the party today, but a place where, you know, I at least would predict we will see continued movement toward the kind of new consensus that has already formed elsewhere.
No, I would agree. And I think if nothing else, it kind of puts to bed the idea that the people concerned with what Wall Street are doing are kind of the old school Occupy Wall Street type protesters. That is a significantly outdated, I think, mental image for DC professionals and elected officials and party, you know, professionals to be carrying around. That is just simply not true. A whole bunch, in fact, 3 in 4 of lower class GOP voters think that way as well. All right, give us one more of yours. What do you think?
All right, one more for me. I want to talk unions. I guess this is the worker power hour here on my side. We've looked at general attitudes toward supporting tight labor markets. Let's go a step further. What do Republican voters think at this point about unions? And this time, you know, we specified up front, this question is about private sector unions, which represent workers at businesses. It is not about public sector unions, which represent teachers, police officers, and other public employees. But in that context, we said some people argue that unions are a positive force because they give workers a say at work, improve wages and benefits, and combat corporate power. Other people argue that unions are a negative force because they interfere with worker freedom, harm employers, and raise prices for consumers. Which is closer to your view? Now, Chris, I got to criticize you a little bit. You haven't done a great job with the reveal, as we reality TV hosts say, and just jump to the answer. So let me hold that back a little longer. The two terms or options we gave people were either unions are a positive force that help workers and reduce corporate power, or unions are a negative force that harm workers, employers, and consumers. And in this one, Republican voters were still to the more, you know, traditional old right view. 59% unions are a negative force that harm workers, employers, and consumers. 41% unions are a positive force that help workers and reduce corporate power. So not a majority for the unions are a positive force view, but also not the sort of obvious consensus that one certainly would have expected traditionally on the right of center. You know, you start to break that down by class, you see some shifting, you know, lower class voters closer to being what you might call pro-union, middle and upper class voters and working class voters a little further away, but all within that sort of 60-40 range. And then when you go back down there and look by priority and, you know, by segment of the electorate, you see old right voters quite strongly still, 72% unions are a negative force. New right voters at this point are at 52% negative, 48% positive. And so I think this, you know, captures another of these really interesting issues that are in flux. I think it's certainly safe to say the issue has shifted from where it might have been in the past. And as we've seen overall, there's much greater appetite for worker power. but not yet necessarily enthusiasm for unions per se. And of course, even at American Compass, there isn't necessarily a lot of enthusiasm for unions per se. We probably spend similar amounts of time talking about the ways that, you know, a labor movement can be a constructive thing, but also the ways that big labor today is not a constructive thing. And so in my view, this sort of highlights this as a topic where there's sort of a lot of opportunity, as you were saying on the Wall Street issue, there's sort of a lot of opportunity for entrepreneurial leadership. I think for the candidate or elected official who wanted to take this on and figure out, hey, how can I address this in a way that's going to be attractive to my constituents, there's a lot of room for progress. But I think your less creative politician is likely to look at this and say, this is just not what I want to be talking about at all right now.
I think what strikes me the most, just to continue on that line of thinking, is this the starting point that this offers to an entrepreneurial policymaker. If the question as framed, because the question as framed is about unions as they exist now, in their current form, which as you intimated is kind of widely seen as broken in a lot of ways. If the result is that mixed and in flux in terms of our current broken union system, to me that points in the direction of, you know, the question, how much better would it be if you were framing this question in a different way? Would you support XYZ alternative form of worker organizing or alternative mechanism of worker collective voice and power? And, you know, obviously that's speculative and beyond the scope of this survey report. But that's how I read it. That it's a pretty positive starting point for a policymaker that wanted to go in that direction.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, one other thing that jumps to mind for me, and it's interesting to look at these, the Wall Street question and the union question, which are sort of close to 60-40 in opposite directions at this point. And you could say, well, you know, you and I are just being hypocritical or engaged in wishful thinking. Somehow we looked at 60-40 on one question and said, wow, look at this, you know, people, you know, great opportunity. It's shifted in our direction. And then look at 60-40 the other way and say, look at that, also a great, also
a great
opportunity.
Hope, Warren. We live in hope.
You got to. But I think, you know, the reason that actually makes sense in my mind is what you're talking about is two issues where what the electorate has historically heard from leaders is only one side of it. That is, that in a context where what is being talked about in the party, in the publications, on the stump, is only Wall Street good, unions bad, you still see in the electorate a view that is, well, actually, we kind of think Wall Street is not so good, and we're not even sure unions aren't good. And so what I think the kind of interesting counterfactual, which also then kind of becomes the opportunity, is, well, gosh, how would people react if they actually started hearing politicians say the opposite? And I think that's where at in you know, potentially, and of course, then also when you zoom out and start to think about the entire electorate and not just the Republican mm-hmm. voters, you start to see a lot of the opportunity.
Well, and if you're interested in pursuing that question, please consult our Better Bargain survey, which dives much more deeply and at length about what people think about some of these alternatives.
As always, there is more on all of these topics at AmericanCompass.org.
That's right.
All right.
So,
well, let's,
where does that leave us? Tell us, where does that leave us?
Where does that leave us? It leaves us at the beginning of a 2024 primary cycle where it is not at all clear what issues are going to end up being in focus, if any, and frankly, what positions people are going to take on them. So we will be coming back in many of the weeks to come with our own thoughts on how one can approach these different issues, whether as a candidate or also, I think, very importantly, the media. You know, what the media wants to cover, write stories about, ask questions about is really important as well. And if they want to make it just, you know, focus on a few kind of hot button cultural issues, that sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But, you know, I think you see whether it's in the context of the UAW strike now, potential government shutdown and issues on immigration and so forth, there's going to be an awful lot out there. And so we will be there to hold our listeners' hands every step of the way, hold each other's hands perhaps. But let's wrap up here with what is one thing you are keeping an eye on that you are very curious to see where it goes in the weeks to come?
Well, I'm very curious to see whether or not the House of Representatives manages to communicate something coherent to the American public about what it's doing in the face of the shutdown that's likely to happen shortly. In my view, they haven't really done that yet. And I'll be interested to see whether there is a clear and resonant economic message that they can pin to the procedural maneuvering that's happening that speaks to some of these deeply felt concerns in the public.
All right. Well, I wish you luck with that.
I'm not holding my breath.
Well, I for my part am excited for the China speeches. I don't know how quickly they will come, but I think certainly there are a lot of candidates who recognize that the China issue is front and center. It's a place where new things need to be said. There's an opportunity for leadership. You know, it's interesting if you even go in and look at Governor DeSantis' economic speech or Ambassador Haley's economic speech, they are both framed around the China challenge, but then don't actually say much about what you would therefore do about the China challenge.
Oh, that's not true, Oren. Ambassador Haley's speech was very clear that it's freedom that's going to help us beat China. And in all seriousness, I think one of the things I'll be watching for is how people define that word. It's obviously a serious word that has a lot of purchase in political rhetoric and campaign language. And I think it's going to be a really interesting question, as you said, for the media and for voters to actually ask candidates what they mean when they say freedom. Because if economic freedom means, you know, letting Wall Street do whatever it wants, that's a very different thing than freedom in the sense of making sure that working people have the freedom to thrive in their families and communities, that American industry is free to thrive, and so on. I think, all jokes aside, what candidates mean by freedom in the economic context would be a really good question for the media to keep in mind as they're interviewing and questioning the candidates.
Very well said. Well, on that note, we will wrap up this first episode of Season 2. We will be back soon with more of Issues 2024. Please check out all of the detailed results of this polling at AmericanCompass.org. And Mr. Griswold, it's a pleasure to be back with you.
Likewise.